everyone. Welcome to Opinionated. Quick forward before this episode begins. We are reviewing Alien, which, if you did not know, does deal with some troubling themes as a horror film. If you're a fan of the movie and this sounds like new information to you, you'll probably find this podcast very interesting. However, if you're unfamiliar with the film or unfamiliar with some of the subtext that has been discussed critically regarding the film, it takes sort of a dark turn. So viewer discretion advised going forward. Well, you're not viewers, you're listeners. Listener discretion advised. Well, I still want you to listen to it, though. Like, I mean, if you guys don't listen to it, we can't really, like, our numbers go down, and that's bad. But if you are sensitive to some rather serious subject matter, just know that's going to be talked about. Here we go. Hello and welcome to Opinionated. My name is Chris Kies. I'm a filmmaker and video content producer from Nashville, Tennessee, and I'm also an intergalactic space capitalist.
Well, I'm Rick Fox, aspiring author, and I am the War Doctor's poor, poor throat.
And we're opinionated. What are we watching tonight?
We are watching Alien, a classic horror movie from 1979.
Alien has a 97% on Rotten Tomatoes. Alien stars Sigourney Weaver, Tom Skerritt, and Ian Holm. It is directed by Ridley Scott. And it has won one Oscar. Well, I'm just looking at that. Which Oscar did it win? I bet it was cinematography. It won Best Visual Effects, which is due to the efforts of H.R. Giger and others.
Interesting, because that's going to be one of the things I'm most hard on it about, probably. But anyway, after a space merchant vessel perceives an unknown transmission as a distress call, they really should reword that in the thing. Let me reread that.
Do we just want to start over? I feel like this has been...
I mean, can you cut this together in a way that makes it work?
I can cut it together. It'll be fine.
Okay. After a space merchant vessel perceives an unknown transmission as a distress call, their landing on the source planet finds one of the crew attacked by a mysterious life form. Continuing their journey back to Earth with the attacked crew having recovered and the critter deceased. What the hell? Who the fuck wrote this? Let me just wing this real quick.
All right. That's science fiction, like, plot synopsis.
Seriously, that is awful. All right. After a space mining crew picks up a distress signal, a alien life form begins picking their crew off one by one. And I am reading this like William Shatner.
To be fair, there are a lot of other moving pieces that make it a pretty complex story, but it is essentially as Ridley Scott pitched it to the studio, Jaws in Space. So I think he kind of nailed it on the head. I believe Cameron Hunt will be joining us this evening. And
yeah, I will. Wild card.
I told you to turn your mic off.
I know you did, but I've been here the whole time.
As I understand it, you've actually never seen this movie before. Is that correct?
Not really, no.
That is interesting.
The resident alien not having watched it person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I almost feel bad. I
continue my long streak of not having seen classic movies and calling myself a filmmaker.
I feel kind of bad having read the plot synopsis even. Like, I realize that there's nothing in the film culture.
I mean, I know what it's about. Yeah. Like, I mean, don't live under a rock.
I mean, you do. I've seen it.
If you haven't seen it, you kind of have lived under a rock.
Yeah.
No, I mean, there's a literal rock in his room. I've seen it. He lives under it. It's embarrassing. It's kind of like Patrick from
SpongeBob. Yeah, I was just thinking the same thing, actually.
Well, anyway, a lot of similarities to this film.
I can't see my forehead.
I saw this movie for the first time, not terribly, terribly long ago, I don't think. It's been a few years, but it wasn't an early film I saw in my life. But I like it. I think that the second one is better, but I recognize what this one is for when it was made. And I started to appreciate its aesthetic a lot more once I played the video game that recently came out based on it.
They made a video game about this?
They made several video games based on the Alien property.
It was kind of a...
Oh, party foul, rude. Podcast foul.
I don't even know why that happened.
I do.
I don't have any alarms set to 7-Eleven. That's such a strange alarm to set.
Yeah. Makes me think that there's something really weird that you don't want to tell us about.
What did we like? What did, oh yeah, something really weird. Dinner's done. Oh, so embarrassing. Anyway, what did that interrupt? What happened?
Video
what
were games? We talking
about? Video games? Yeah. Oh yeah, Alien Isolation. It was kind of a big marketing ploy because it was about like the experience of what it would be like to be in the movie.
It was actually very interesting. It's not actually in the movie
specifically, to not spoil anything,
but yeah.
It does not lend itself to something like a video game, but it seemed to be mixed.
So it's kind of like Metal Gear Solid.
It did survival horror extremely well, and that's unusual in this day and age. You generally, if you have survival horror or anything that's called that, you have way too much power in your hands as the player.
To bring it back to the movie, yeah. My first experience watching this was actually in college, my freshman year. One of my buddies, Ian, down the hall, I could hear him watching something, and I just sort of like knocked on the door. I was like, "Hey, man, what are you doing?" He's like, "Oh, I'm watching Alien." And I was like, "Oh, I've never seen that," and I'd never really had an interest to for whatever reason. And he sort of freaked out. And this, to me, you know, I sort of took it with a grain of salt because I was like, you know, Ian wasn't really like a cinephile. He's just like this dude who was studying graphic design, and like I think his favorite movies were mostly movies I did not really care for. So he was like, "But dude, you gotta watch it." He just pushed it so hard, and I was like, "All right, fine, I'll hang out and I'll watch it." And it was like 2 in the afternoon. And it's a horror movie from the late '70s, and I was completely captivated by it. I thought it was very, very interesting and thrilling to watch. And one of my favorite memories actually watching any movie is actually with you, Rick, and our buddy Jacob.
Oh, that was a good time.
It was like midnight and we started the first one. And at the end, and like we weren't saying anything through it. And in the middle, like amidst a bunch of silence, Jacob just goes, "My butthole's clenched so hard right now." And like I thought that I was so like excited that he was into it, mm-hmm. because it was super late, and I mean it's an older movie, it's a little dated, but it holds up really well. And then we all enjoyed watching it so much, even though it was about 2 or 3 at that time, we still started the second movie immediately afterward.
I'm actually looking forward to doing the second movie more than I am this one. But let's go ahead and get to it.
Yeah, let's go ahead and watch Alien. Guys, you are welcome to join us and write down some notes. All these youths around here.
Stay off my lawn.
Could it be that I'm out of touch?
No, surely not.
It's the okay. children that are wrong.
Yes. Absolutely. See what I did there?
You made a fart joke.
Yep. I'm going to keep making them too. It's my objective during this podcast to make as many fart puns as possible.
So can we cut off his mic? Is that an option?
I believe that I have that power, but I don't plan on abusing it. Okay. I don't think that'd be quite fair. All right, so
First Amendment.
So one of the things I wanted to mention before we got started tonight is the time frame of when this movie came out. We just came off the heels of Alien. Just finished watching it. This movie came out in 1979. So for frame of reference, that is 2 years after Star Wars came out, which was really the... I mean, there have obviously been several other classic science fiction films that have come out previously.
But that was the one that mattered.
You know, well, this is the first, like, major blockbuster, heavy special effects. You know, it was a really immersive experience. And I feel like all the other sci-fi films had these tropes of, like, you know, they're basically fantasy films with, like, blonde bimbos. They're princesses you got to save. And it's basically...
You're Flash Gordon.
Yeah, you know, they're all Flash Gordons. You know, they have these flamboyant costumes. It's... They sort of went for this raw escapism that doesn't really translate to a completely, forgive the pun, alien environment as space would be. So Star Wars being one of the first films to sort of do that on a level that actually sells, which is ironic because that is also a fantasy film. Off the tail of that, we get Alien just 2 years later.
And I was curious to see just broad thoughts. Like, what were y'all's, like, what similarities did you guys notice? Do you feel like there's any connections?
Between, oh, absolutely. Like, yeah. Every external shot, when you're outside in space looking at the spaceship, looked like it was a close up of the Death Star or a Star Destroyer. Like all the movement shots, you know, like when the shuttle, like for instance, at the end when the shuttle is taking off from the main ship and it's like speeding away, it looks exactly like the scene in the opener to A New Hope where the Star Destroyer is coming up on the Corvette.
For me, what's interesting is the dissimilarities, because just the way the ship looks, it looks like nothing that I've seen in Star Wars, just because in Star Wars, it feels like, you know, those are clearly spaceships other than the Death Star, but that even clearly has like a moon stellar type
distance,
thing.
From a distance, it looks different.
Like, it looks like a floating fortress. I definitely see what you're talking about.
It looks identical.
I definitely see what you're talking about there. It's just, it's interesting to me that they chose to go with something so unspaceship like.
It is. I would say that it looks the way like a spaceship might actually look of that size and caliber in the future as a frigate, like not necessarily as like a,
isn't it like a tow ship or something like that?
It's a mining ship.
So it's the most unsexy possible type of ship we could probably
invent. You are correct. It is a commercial towing vehicle that is carrying a refinery with 20 million tons of mineral ore.
Have a license to park your Lambda class shuttle there? We're gonna have to tow that, guys. I'm really sorry about this. That's what the corporation wants, you know. We got to get everyone their shares.
Man.
That is a theme throughout the movie.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I felt that was really interesting. And I think the point you brought up, Cameron, is probably going to be my biggest point as well, is just the general approach to, like, you know, those first few shots where we first see the ship, you know, it definitely evokes that same imagery. You know, you're trying to get a sense of space in the film. And the environment is also just as much a character as I think, if not more so than most of the actual characters in this movie. So I feel like establishing that was very important, and I think they learned a lot from the success of A New Hope, and the cinematic language I think is just very strong there.
Was it ILM that did A New Hope? Like, weren't they consistent through the whole thing?
I don't know if they were a full-fledged company yet.
I think that Star Wars is what launched them as a company.
Well, just all that to say, like, what I mean is, I remember watching some documentary or special features or something one time that talked about how Star Wars used models in a way that like nobody else had really done before with that degree of success, and just like all the models and force perspective and camera angles and just like basically the way that they put it all together. Anyway, it just reminded me a lot of that, you know, a lot of the same techniques I think were used in creating all the external space shots or the ship shots. And so yeah, it had a very Star Wars-y feel, which is not a bad thing.
It definitely works and holds up in a way that, you know, it could be very cheesy and very bad, but it feels not
like
real.
Other special effects in the movie.
Yes, there are some that do not work nearly as well. But for the most part, I'd say they're, especially for a movie that is now almost 40 years old, it's extremely impressive.
Yeah, I think it's held up very, very well for the most part.
Yeah.
Shall we go ahead and start going through the synopsis? Rick, you're the historian for the plot tonight.
We start off, this movie is in a lot of ways very slow at the beginning. We start off with these long shots of space, and then we slowly get towards getting our first shots of the Nostromo, and then we slowly move into it, and then slowly we move throughout the ship, getting a good look at a bunch of pieces of it before we finally get to our kind of birth scene of people coming out of their pods and waking up.
So this is actually like my first note, actually. It is very unconventional the way it opens up. Like, it's even A New Hope, you know, it's sort of known for having sort of a slow first act, but even A New Hope opens with a huge ship battle.
Huge ship battle, bombastic music, like just this crazy thing at the beginning. It's a very big opener there.
I think that Alien is decidedly, and to its favor, like obviously chose a very different approach with its opening act. And I think that if you get in the mindset of, especially if you've seen the trailer, you know, it gives you very little information and you're not sure what to expect, but you know that it's supposed to be pretty terrifying and that it's by Ridley Scott, you know, it's getting a lot of good critical acclaim. It's pretty buzzed up. Like, it's supposed to be this interesting picture. I don't know about you guys, but when I go to see a horror movie that I've heard is really good, I'm pretty much already on the edge of my seat before the movie starts because I don't know if I'm fully prepared for it. To have such a decidedly slow opening and specifically the these specific scenes and shots that are implemented, I think, are really effective with the themes of the movie. The fact that you're crawling through this ship that's clearly lived in, but you don't see anyone living, and you don't know yet that they're all asleep. You don't know where anyone is. Sort of how everyone feels throughout the whole movie. They know that something is there, yeah, but they can't see it. And that evokes a really interesting sense of dread early on, which is in a way not warranted, but that makes it almost more frightening.
You do have this sort of voyeuristic feel to it as you go through the ship at the very beginning there. You feel like an outside presence coming in.
Yeah.
And the slow way that the camera moves kind of gives you this sense of being predatory, much the same way that, you know, this is often called Jaws in space, but this feels a lot like those scenes from the shark's perspective in Jaws to me.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is this, I can't think of an earlier example, but is this the earliest example you guys can think of a lived-in universe? Because I wouldn't call Star Wars that precisely.
What do you mean a lived-in universe? Like it just has an established lore already existing behind it?
No, what I mean is it looks like this place is the kind of thing you might expect. It looks trashed up, it looks banged up, nothing looks new, it looks personalized in a lot of ways. You'll see, you know, like cubbies of some guy, one guy has, you know, porn stuck to walls, that kind of thing, like you'd expect in a truck driver, you know, back of his car. This is the earliest example I can think of that type of lived in universe where it looks worn down, it looks screwed up, it looks like people live here.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily, to me that just translates as like strong production design. Because,
well, I mean, Star Wars has strong production design, but sure, that's very, very different. To me, a lived-in universe looks like people live there. Star Wars doesn't feel that way to me. Everything there is pristine. It looks good, you know, or it looks, you know, very, very evil in the case of the Death Star, but none of it looks trashed up. It doesn't look like, you know, no one's workspace is dirty there. Everything is very movie-like to me.
I think it just sort of depends on, like, the themes you're going for. And I guess I think I see what you're saying. I mean, on the one hand, I can't say that I can think of an example off the top of my head of an example of that. But I feel like that's not necessarily like an innovation that the movie takes. But I do think it's something that the movie did very well in its credit. Because if it had taken more of a Star Wars-y route and tried to make everything, because on Star Wars, everything's pretty black and white, at least in A New Hope, right? Like you sort of, there's no real tiny details to glean from. You can't like go to the corner of the frame and see a date that reveals everything you need to know about a character in the back corner of the room that doesn't talk, you know? But this movie kind of has details like that where I feel like if you were to crop in on a specific picture frame, you would learn something about someone. And in that perspective, is that sort of what you mean?
Not like, in the least.
Okay, I'm completely lost then.
Okay, it's the difference between a model house. When if you come to an apartment, it doesn't look like someone lives there. But if you come into an apartment that is the same apartment as far as how it looks, but someone lives there, there's trash in the areas, there might be like dirty clothes on someone's floor, like that kind of thing. It looks lived in. That's the difference that I'm trying to get you.
Well, then, yeah, I would say not necessarily, but I also can't think of any direct examples off the top of my head because that's not necessarily something I guess I think about.
Right. Personally. It's a thing that I think has become kind of a trope in horror space movies specifically. Ones that I can think of, or the one that comes to mind off the top of my head that in a lot of ways rips off this movie is, what is it called?
Thinking of Event Horizon.
Yes, Event Horizon. Event Horizon shamelessly rips off this beginning, and
I watched it very recently, and I did not like it at all.
I feel like it would be a good one for the podcast. There's things that I like about it a lot, and there are things that do not work at all. but yeah, there's a lot of there's a lot of personality to the ship, and not in a way that tells you big themes necessarily, I would say, but in ways that makes it feel like these people do live here. That's the important thing to me.
Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts on that, Cameron?
Not really. I mean, I'm kind of with Chris, you know, that it didn't really strike me as something that I would pay attention to. I mean, like it's cool, you know, that I would just chalk it up to strong production design though, the same way, you know, that just, that's just the way they designed the ship. Mm-hmm. For me, I think a lot of the opening, and I think a lot of this movie in general, for me, it's like, if this movie, or not this movie, I'm sorry, if Star Wars A New Hope and 2001 Space Odyssey had a baby together, and that baby turned into a horror movie, it would be Alien. And what I think about is, like, especially, like, speaking specifically to the opening, like, all, like 2001 has so many of those, like, slow, drawn out moments, you know, like that movie is kind of a chore to watch a little bit.
We might have to do that.
It's like exercise. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's a,
we might have to do that one at some point since I've never seen it.
Really? Oh, man. Yeah.
It's a trip.
It really is.
Everything that I've heard about it makes me think that I'm going to hate it.
You will.
Yeah, you will. It's an artistic exercise. And it's one of those, it's one of those movies that, like, the entertainment is found in appreciating the raw artistry of it.
So it's like pushing your glasses up further on your nose.
Oh, yes.
Else can.
Yes. My glasses are up so high right now.
Fun factoid. I believe that movie came out in 1976, right before Star Wars.
Yeah.
It was the highest grossing film that year.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
A lot of people getting high and going in there.
There's actually a lot of, like, a lot of, you don't want to talk about snooty people. There's a lot of snooty people that, like, want to blame Star Wars for ruining movies. Because after Star Wars, every highest, like, budgeted, or not budgeted, every highest, like, box office earner every subsequent year was, like, a high action science fiction or fantasy film. Oh, and before that, it was all the films that, like, critics talk about today as being, like, the golden children of films, like, the ones that inspired movies like Star Wars to get made. But like it's ironic that the trend changed after that, you know, like that after Star Wars, it sort of Hollywood started to dumb down a little bit. Yeah. Well, yeah.
So you have
an argument for both ways. Like, they would say that that's why Michael Bay is successful, because of a film like Star Wars. You know, I'm not saying I necessarily agree with it. I'm obviously an enormous Star Wars fan. So, but it's interesting. And we should definitely cover that in another podcast.
Yeah.
But back to Alien.
Yeah. So, anyway, back to what I was saying.
The important part of the
derailed. The movie. Just the opening sequence, I think one of the biggest things that stuck out to me was what you guys were talking about with the way the camera moves around. You see all this stuff that looks like people live there, but you don't see any people, you know, and you kind of don't know what's going on. I saw a little bit of similarity or parallel between the way that the people emerge from the pods, like, to how the alien kind of emerges from the person. And so, like,
that
it's kind of a slow, like, it's a bit of foreshadowing almost, you know, that it's a slow trickle out where you have this one dramatic happening.
Right.
And then from there, it's like more and more people getting up and getting out.
Yeah, I can see that.
Until they're all out, you know, kind of the same way with the alien.
There is a running theme throughout this entire movie is very, very sexual imagery. And I feel like that part of the movie really has a lot of birth imagery going on. Like, they all come out wearing diapers, essentially, like, among other things. But that is a running theme throughout the entire film is sexual imagery. And it definitely starts there. But then from there, we move on to a scene that just about, it feels like every other space movie copies, in that you have a sudden scene of everyone talking at the beginning to kind of get you into these characters and let you know a little bit about who they are and, you know, make you feel like you're family with them. But yeah, we kind of get to know, I feel like Parker is the biggest personality there, but we get a little bit of an insight into everyone here. We get a little bit of power dynamics going on. And it gives you a further look into who these people are, I think. And I think that's very useful at the beginning of this movie to make these people into people in your mind. I feel like a lot of times with horror movies, at least these days, the trick is to make everyone just so hateful and make you despise them so that you kind of are rooting for the bad guy throughout the film. But this movie very much does not take that tack.
I think you hate all the people in the horror films.
Well, I mean, like, a lot of times you have, you know, you have the, these days it's, you know, you have the lame stoner. I don't get the joke that's going on here.
Okay, for everybody who's, we're going to take a little dive into the mind of Cameron really quick. So you're talking about how they write horror movies to make you hate them. But I think it's that they make you, Rick, hate them, not the average person.
No, I don't think that's the case at all.
Because
I think he's making a joke.
Most people, I think most people are super relatable to the people in horror movies. And, like, just like kind of those, you know, I don't know. They usually don't let me talk this long, so I've kind of lost it.
I mean, like, give me an example of a recent.
I get what he's saying. It's like
him or me. Yeah.
It's like how you hate the people in the Fast and the Furious franchise, but they're not designed to be hated.
I disagree. I think in a lot of cases, the people that die specifically are there to be hated. They are usually, in one way, you know, it's kind of a trope to have, you know, the characters that die, they're.
What are you doing? Let him talk. Let him talk. Respect his opinion.
I was making an obscene gesture. Sorry, everybody.
The usual way that these movies kind of play out is that you have various characters that, quote unquote, commit some kind of sin, and that's why they die. You have the stoner who's the pothead. You have the characters that have sex. That gets them killed. And I think that in more recent trends, they've taken those things to such extremes that you have characters that you're designed to hate. And it's because they are, like, you have the jock who's a jerk. You have, you know, the bimbo girl that just is so annoying because she's so stupid. Like, that type of character is what they've kind of designed as the horror movie standard. And I think it's interesting that this movie kind of predates that and does not take that route at all.
I see what you're saying. And I agree with the latter half that the movie intentionally avoids a lot of horror tropes.
I think it predates a lot of horror tropes, honestly. It really does. I mean, at least slasher movie tropes.
Is this movie really a horror movie though? Or is it a suspense? So. Yes, like, yes. I mean, I would call it more like suspense or thriller. Like, for me, like, a horror movie is, like, I think far more, I don't know. I guess I don't like horror movies. So that could have also a huge bit. Like, I don't like that personally. And, I mean, I can keep talking through that.
How would you define a horror movie then?
Well, like a movie like, what was that movie called?
Saw.
The Grudge, The Ring. The Ring, you know, like those types of movies that are like paranormal or even you're Freddy Krueger, like, mm-hmm. Was it
Night- so is a slash
Nightmare on Elm Street.
Nightmare on Elm Street, or your Jason movies,
Friday the 13th, yeah.
Scream, you know, that right. kind of stuff. Like, those, to me, those are what I think of when I think of, like, a horror movie. Mm-hmm. But a movie like this, to me, really racks in more as, like, a suspense or a thriller, because it's not, I'm not, like, the movie doesn't, for me, at least, I'm not scared in the movie. Like, but like these other movies, like, you know, like, they make you scared. Whereas this movie is more like has you on edge the whole time, where it's just like a really gripping action sequence throughout the whole thing.
I would say that at least in my opinion, the tension is kind of what is missing from a lot of horror movies today. I don't get scared in a lot of horror movies today because it's, you know, they're kind of what you're talking about. They're slasher movies. Mm-hmm. They're not, and again, to me, a lot of the characters in that type of movie aren't characters. They're stereotypes that are there to be killed. And that's, you know, it's not scary to me for that reason. Mm-hmm. And I feel like this movie, what it does well is it gets you to empathize with these characters. And, you know, like, I think that scene that we were talking about earlier that kind of kicked us off is a big part of what does that. It gets you to empathize with these people. It gets you to see them as people before it ever gets to the point where any of them are in danger. So you kind of see them devolve in a lot of cases to very, you know, being terrified and being mm-hmm. there. And that kind of takes you along with that ride. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what this is designed to do. And that's why I would call it horror. Because that to me is what horror is making you feel fear for the character. I guess that tension is kind of what I think of as horror.
So I would say that I agree and disagree very passionately with what you're both saying. And I also want to close out the argument. So I am going to be Captain Final Thought. And if I was a musician, I would put a theme here that was like, Captain Final Thoughts, but I'm not, so that'll have to do. I think 80% of what Rick is saying is 100% on the money here with how you define the traditional horror film, and, like, you know, that it does have those stereotypes in there. And this film sort of predates or subverts those tropes altogether. But I'm with Cameron's first point in that I don't get why you think they have to be people you don't like. That's something I personally don't get.
I don't mean that in all horror movies. That's a thing of horror movies that I don't like. I think it's a bad decision in those types of movies.
But I've never seen a horror movie where everyone who dies is someone I didn't like. So that's what I mean. It doesn't seem to be a trope that exists to me.
Do you watch a lot of bad slasher movies, though?
I've seen Nightmare on Elm Street. I've seen Halloween 2. I have seen Sleepaway Camp, which is like the worst movie. And I also passionately disagree with Cameron's point with the horror thriller conversation, not necessarily on a base of merit or intellectual thought. That's just like the most tired argument to me when it comes to how you categorize horror movies, because it seems to me like a lot of people will try to sell a horror movie. Like, you should see The Grudge. And someone will be like, oh, I don't like scary movies. And their immediate response is, well, it's more of a thriller. And it's sort of like they try to reel like someone else into the fold. And like, oh, well, thriller doesn't sound quite as intimidating. I feel like I've never seen a thriller that I could also not call a horror movie. So to me, you know, I see them as the same genre.
I would say that I think that the reason for that is that I think horror movie in general has a lot of, evokes a lot of bad imagery in people's heads. And I don't mean that in terms of scary things or, you know, blood and guts and that kind of thing. What I mean by bad is, I mean, people think of, at least I think of bad movies when I think of like what the, what horror movies is. I think of the later Friday the 13th. I think of the later Nightmare on Elm Street. And I think that's where the genre kind of got to sort of at its height when it was the most popular, because it's kind of died out in a lot of ways recently.
I mean, I think the ultimate horror movie of all time is The Exorcist. Like, that's...
I've never seen that. We should watch that.
Yeah, that movie is messed up. And I don't want to watch it again. But that's just, again, that's a personal taste thing. I'm not really a fan of those types of things.
Is it specifically the demonic angle that gets to you, or?
Yeah, it just bothers me. You know, like, I just don't, all movies like that. Like, there's another one, it's a Denzel Washington movie, mm-hmm. where there's like a demon serial killer that he's tracking. Right. That movie really messed with me. Like, really, you know, just, I don't know, like those movies that lean into that kind of stuff. Like, this is, again, just my personal taste. Like, they just make me feel weird after I watch them, and fair so I choose not to.
I tend to lean into that kind of thing because I find that interesting. When I find something that gets that type of emotional reaction out of me, that makes me interested.
It's interesting, but I just don't like the way it makes me feel.
That's fair.
But anyway, my point being that when I think of a horror movie, like a movie like The Exorcist is my ultimate example. Whereas when I think of you know. I don't want to say thriller, you know, I the other word I used earlier was suspense, you know, that I think of a movie like Hitchcock, like The Birds, you know, or something like that, you know, that it's more leans towards the suspense element. And yes, there are scary elements in the movie, but that's what plays to the suspense. And I think a movie like Alien, in my mind, plays far more to the Hitchcock or The Birds, you know, type film than The Exorcist. And that's why I wouldn't really personally want to call it a horror film or even a thriller, you know, that it's more of a suspense action film. But that's just my take on it based on those criteria.
Right.
So let's let that be the final thought and let's move on.
So
we're about 30 minutes in and we've covered
the opening scene.
We haven't gotten to any dialogue yet.
I do think that this is the type of movie that will pick up very quickly as we go along to it, because that's it has a very slow opening. There's a lot of information that kind of gets fed into
our podcast, very kind of much mirrors the film itself.
Well, we
planned that, everybody. We planned that.
Well, so what we get after this is we find out why they've been woken up. Because at the beginning, they're kind of very happy to be awake. They think that they're home. They think that they're going to be, you know, at you know, back at Earth immediately. And that is very much not the case. They end up, you know, finding out that they are very, very far away from home, and it's going to take them a lot longer to get home because they've had to make this detour, and apparently it's because of this, you know, distress signal. And I like this. It, again, gets you right on their side immediately. It, you know, you kind of, that's a very understandable, like, everyone has had to stay at work a little later than they wanted to, much less, like, 10 months
later.
Yeah, exactly. So I feel like that's really interesting.
You've got Parker and the guy who looks like a janitor, and he pretty much is a janitor. What's his name? The guy who dies first. What's his name? They're talking about their shares.
Brett.
Okay, so Parker and Brett, you know, they immediately go into this thing where Brett even signals Parker. He does this little thing with his hand, and Parker sees it and goes, oh, by the way, I wanted to talk about the share situation. And I really like that little subplot, because not only does it sort of establish this sort of subconscious theme that Ridley Scott has going throughout the movie, which is, you know, I feel like something having to do with like socialism and capitalism, and how, like, you know, when you're working for a big company, they're never going to have your best interests at heart. Their interest is the bottom line. I feel like that subplot works pretty well as a theme throughout the movie, even though it's not the central focus. That little tidbit in the beginning, you know, I think that's actually before we learn about the distress signal.
It's about the same time. Yeah. They're kind of discussing their bonuses and that kind of thing. Yeah. And, you know, they're clearly feel as though they're not getting their worth.
It opens with this really, I almost want to say, like, human angle.
Oh, yeah,
you
definitely.
Know, it's very natural. Mm-hmm. You know, that's because we only see humans right now, and they're doing what we'd all do. We'd talk about work. We talk about how terrible the food is. And, you know, we just sort of just shoot it for a while. And eventually, you know, we're like, oh, we got this thing to do. And they just go and do it. I feel like in most modern movies, you know, they'd play all of this up a lot. They'd wake up and they'd immediately be like, all right, well, let's go home. And it's sort of going to be a little like hammed up and cartoony because they're trying to like keep the energy up to keep the audience awake. And, you know, in that idea's, you know, favor, you know, this can be the type of film where if you're watching it, you know, and it's, you know, a Sunday afternoon, I could see you dozing off in the first few minutes because you're not used to this type of pacing. But it also works really well for, I feel like, what we set up going forward.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. So they get to the planet, they, you know, land on there. And this place is really, really creepy. Like it is, it feels like this, you know, frozen, terrifying place. And they're forced to kind of go along, and their ship actually breaks a little bit as they come down, which gives you further, you know, insight into, you know, how these people feel. You know, we get this scene that I find kind of funny where, you know, the two engineers are going back and forth with the captain, you know, talking about how long it's going to take them to get out of here. And one engineer, you know, not on the mic, says it'll take us 17 hours to repair everything. And the other guy clicks on the mic and goes, it's going to take us about 25 hours to get everything done here. And that again, it's another one of those, you know, humanizing moments where you really get you understand these people. You feel like you know people that are like this.
I feel like I know people who are like that.
Yeah.
I feel like I know people who are like that. Do we all? Rick?
Yeah.
Oh, well. Hey, okay. We agree on something, guys.
Good job.
Wow.
Good job, guys. We agree. This movie's perfect.
It's our moment.
So, you know, they eventually get to the ship, and that ship has so much weird architecture to it. It's very clear. Yeah,
like, it is so interesting.
The design here is very, it's both very phallic and very yonic, which is the opposite of phallic, if you guys didn't know.
Oh, wait, you're talking about the actual alien ship.
Yeah.
I was talking about the Nostromo. Oh. That ship is weird. I mean, it's good. Like it's totally serves the film. And I just don't imply that. I love this phallic ship. I feel like it sends kind of an uncomfortable message.
Well, I think this whole movie is very much designed to send that. Again, I mentioned the sexual imagery earlier, and I think that is a big part of why this is the way it is.
I just didn't pick up on any of that. Maybe I need to watch it more than once.
It's very subliminal.
It's very, yeah, it is hard to pick up if you're not looking for it, but once you know it's there, it's everywhere throughout the movie.
It's actually pretty, like, once you notice it, it makes the film a lot more disturbing to watch because you start to see a lot of underlying themes that are very uncomfortable to talk about.
Specifically, the big theme, and this is something that the director, you know, really worked to bring out of the movie, is that the big theme of this movie is rape. There's, you know, the main guy who first gets attacked, he gets things shoved into him that he does not want, and
pretty much
he gets a baby that he does not want, and it kills him. And from that point on, you know, the monster is kind of hunting people down. And there's one scene in particular that we'll get to at the end that is extreme. I wish that you listeners could see the look on Cameron's face. It's very like, oh, I've suddenly realized how horrifying all this stuff was.
Man, okay, I changed my mind. This is a horror film.
Right?
This is a horror film. Holy.
Yeah.
You've pieced it all together now.
Yeah. Are we allowed to swear on this podcast? I can't remember.
I mean, if it's too bad, I'll probably bleep it out.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
It's a mind bender. Now, like, go back and rewatch it, and you're like, wow, this is everywhere.
When you put it in that light, like, that is disturbing.
It is. And it's intended to be so. Like, that is the entire purpose of the movie. And I think it's a big part of why the male characters are the ones that get picked off mostly at the beginning. It, you know, it's something else to unsettle the viewer. It's an unusual way to go at that. Yeah. So
to, you know, eggs, I guess.
Yeah, the eggs are in this ship, and we get a look at this very creepy alien that has been driving the ship. And
oh man, what is that? That thing's called something. It's called like the Space Jockey.
Yeah.
That's what it's called. I find it so funny that thing's become such an icon.
Yeah.
Like, it's such a little bit that, like, doesn't really matter. It's sort of, all it is foreshadowing, right?
Yeah, definitely.
It shows, hey, this is a universe where alien is probable. It's not a human-only universe. And
right, because no one's terribly surprised by the alien.
And the imagination's the limit, you know? Like, this thing does not look anatomically like it makes sense.
Yeah, definitely not.
And
the skeleton?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, the skeleton thing. Like, its nose is its rib cage.
It's human-ish,
kind of? Well, it's like an elephant humanoid.
It is a very strange-looking creature, no matter, you know, how you look at it. But it does also have this thing that they mentioned, something has, you know, what killed burst it was something that burst out of it from the inside.
Which is a cool Chekhov's gun if you're not familiar with, like, that now famous, impossible to be unfamiliar with scene.
Right.
Where something does burst out of someone.
Right. But first, something has to burst into something. And that scene is both very creepy to me, the way that John Hurt's character, you know, kind of gets into that situation. It is, you know, they build the tension very well there because of how they, you know, they light up the egg. You see how creepy these things are because those eggs just on their own are creepy. But then you see something moving inside of it, and he notices there's something moving inside it. And instead of doing what you want him to do, which is get out of there, he just leans in, and that was a bad decision.
It was really well done how, like, they do the first person perspective of the camera. And it just keeps getting a better angle. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, it's hard to blame the character when you are the character in that moment, you know, because you're also kind of curious, you know. It sort of subverts that trope that really hasn't probably existed fully yet, where it's like, don't open, just go home, you know, go anywhere else. But when you have that perspective, it sheds a whole new light on it. And it really sort of turns that whole little trope on its head. And I really like that little touch. And the movie's filled with just amazing choices in terms of cinematography that really just get you in that moment.
Yeah,
and
definitely.
I love it. Oh, so well crafted, the whole movie, in my opinion.
I would mostly agree. Once this thing has attached itself to John Hurt, we come back to the ship. And for kind of the second time, we have Ian Holm's character kind of disagreeing with people that are, you know, going on. Ian Holm, by the way, if you don't know who that is, it's Bilbo from The Lord of the Rings.
Bilbo.
Yeah. So anytime just we talk about him, I just want
Shire
you to
in the background if you need a little extra, like, if you just can't make it through all the dark grimness.
But yeah, so he kind of has this.
Oh, God!
Oh, Bilbo just spitting up all that milk.
We'll get to the milk spit. Don't you worry.
So, you know, it's interesting how I think subtly they do a very good job of making it feel just like normal character conflict. But once you watch the movie, you know, the second time, knowing who his character is, it's really interesting to watch how often he does things to make the situation more favorable for the alien.
It also seems like, I feel like if we didn't know that Ripley was sort of the front runner here, that she's, you know, the franchise, the face of the franchise, right? If we didn't know that, we wouldn't know in this movie that she's going to end up as the protagonist.
Definitely
if anything, we're sort of being led to suspect that it might be Ian. I would argue.
I would go towards Dallas myself.
Dallas is also a really good bet, but Ian's the one that is the only one that really shows sort of an illogical sense of compassion, which is sort of, you know, a trope that the protagonist has, is that they have the biggest heart and it's all not real, but he's the one that lets Dallas and the crew in spite of the inherent danger.
I might argue that it is in a sense real, but we'll get to that when we get to the milk scene. That is an important part there.
Well, no, I'm talking about when they let them back into the ship.
I realize I'm saying, I think that the important part of that discussion will come then. So
I'm just
pointing out that I think that there is a interpretation that his compassion is from a sense real.
I see what you mean. I guess what I'm saying is that from the audience's perspective, we can't really guess who the protagonist is. And at this point, the two best bets is one of them dies pretty early.
Yeah.
And even his name, Dallas, I think is not an accident that, you know, the cowboy, like, is the kind of the protagonist you'd expect to have in this movie, is going to shoot it up in the end. and you have Ian Holmes' character, Ash is that guy, is that character's name. Yeah. Ash, who's the only one who, and early on, seems to show that sort of like the traits that a protagonist would have in this type of movie.
Yeah, I can see that.
So
he does seem very concerned with getting him on the ship at all costs.
And if you look at it from that angle, you could see Ripley as one of the antagonists, because she's like, no, don't let them on. I don't care about them. Follow the quarantine.
Definitely.
You know, later you see the perspective that, you know, she was right and she actually had everyone's best interest at heart. But, you know, a lot of films don't lead you to believe that sort of like worldview when you go into it. They try to lead you in the opposite direction. I think that's really interesting and smart.
So they kind of have to get stuck on this on the planet for a little while here while they make the repairs. And it's interesting that when this guy comes back, we don't immediately jump to, you know, explaining what's happened to him. We have these like this long tense scene of, you know, people trying to deal with other concerns going on around the ship. And I think it's interesting that they don't want to hover over, you know, this guy, despite the fact that he is in a very, very dire situation. I think it's another thing that adds to the horror of the situation, because while that is going on, there are still other concerns that have to be taken care of no matter what.
What is the logical paradox where it's like a situation where no matter what, the villain wins?
Catch 22.
No, that's when... That's like the insanity clause, where it's like you can't claim to be insane because then you're not insane. That's what a catch 22 is.
Yeah, it's a situation where both answers are wrong.
Okay, I thought it was something else. Anyway, sorry.
Your description of it was correct.
I
didn't realize what you were referring to.
What I'm getting at is the fact that if you think about this film and the script writing phase, you know, they have to come up with what the alien is. At this point, you know, the alien, like, there's nothing they can really do about it unless they want to straight up kill John Hurt by just throwing him and the alien out the airlock. And that's not really a feasible option for them. But they're all shouting like some pretty good ideas at Ian Holm's character when they're operating on it. Like, why don't you freeze him?
Oh, we're there now?
Yeah, that's where I thought we were. We're experimenting on the alien. Yeah. So I feel like it's really interesting because this is the type of film, you know, a science fiction film. There's so many possibilities. I feel like after the film comes out, the internet, you know, if it was around at this time, a million people would normally be like, why didn't they just do this? The whole movie would have been fine after that. But this movie seems fairly like locked tight at this point, you know, because there really isn't anything you can do about the situation. That really serves the tension very well. You know, think, okay, well, let's try to pry it off. No, it'll choke him. Okay, well, let's cut it. Its blood is acid and they're in space. They cannot have a hole through their hull.
Right.
And then they're like, well, you know, if we just leave him, what happens? You know, we can't throw him out. He's a human being and he's still alive.
One character's constantly asking why they don't freeze him.
Yeah, and I think that's interesting. The movie seems to do that a lot, where all of these characters are constantly offering suggestions, and the suggestions have like strong answers behind why they won't work.
Yeah, it's not one of those movies where you're, you know, yelling at the protagonist for doing something really stupid every 2 seconds. Yeah,
the script everything is they do, really airtight. Is
everything
sort of
they do makes
at.
A lot of sense. So yeah, we you know, kind of after that, we get to, you know, all the repairs that have to be done while we kind of just tensely sit there. But we get a little more character interaction between Ripley and Ash that I think is interesting. And again, it kind of gets to that conflict of who's the protagonist here. Like,
Let him in. Conversation, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, very much. Yeah, that one. It's interesting that she is kind of playing what most people would consider the bad guy. I think I agree with you there that she is as determined as she is to kind of assert her authority there, since she's saying, you know, that when Dallas is off of the ship, I'm the one that's in command. You know,
she's
think that's
playing the jerk boss card.
Yeah, definitely.
Like, she's totally and that even, boss who's like, hey, you know that I'm the one who makes the calls. That's not your not decision.
Even, yeah, and not even necessarily the jerk boss thing, but like the jerk coworker who's technically right, which is even worse, I feel.
That can be worse when you know someone's right, but you just can't stand the way they're going about telling it to you.
Exactly.
That can be pretty terrifying.
Yeah.
I think we've all been there. And that just serves that humanist perspective even mm-hmm. better, which is another element the film does really well. And that brings us to the... They finish repairs and she has a conversation with
Dallas. Yeah, they manage to get back in the ship and, you know, they kind of have to go looking for the alien because it suddenly disappears off of John Hurt's face. But, you know, it kind of just is another scene to, you know, ratchet up your tension a little more when you find it dead. But it kind of dangles in Ripley's face for a second there, which I do kind of question why they made this ship so full of crevices and dark places to hide.
They weren't going to know that some small alien rodent was going to invade it. You know, that's why they have the quarantine procedure because it's not supposed to be something that's ever going to happen. I'm curious to know what Cameron's thoughts are to the movie up to this point, because this is sort of when the movie starts taking that turn down clenched sphincter alley where you can't stop, like, oh, this is getting pretty intense.
Yeah, I mean, I liked it.
Okay.
Best guest.
So you were to at least, you know, to some degree familiar with the scene that was coming up.
Yes.
So you knew, like, despite the fact that he kind of looks okay there and he's eating with everyone and everyone's happy and everything, you knew that the bad stuff
was
going to happen.
Well, it's an icon of pop culture, this scene. You know, I mean, it's when Animaniacs does it, then
that's fair.
then you know it's out there.
Did it work for you knowing it was coming, though?
Oh, yeah, totally.
Okay. Yeah. That's the important thing, I think. I mean,
do you know who did not know it was coming? The actors.
Yeah, I remember hearing about that.
Yeah, like
that blows my mind.
Yeah, like you can tell. Like, there's a lot of things on there that, you know, they look very creepy.
Why don't you recap what happened, Rick? Because you,
I mean, it's pretty simple. They, you know, John Hurt, you know, suddenly looks like he's just fine and everything's okay.
No,
and,
I mean, like the conversation between the director and the actors to stage that scene. Like, you know, so because people listening might not know.
I mean, I know what happened. I don't know about the conversation.
Okay, so like Ridley Scott told, I think maybe two of the actors, the one who's going crazy on the table, and I think Ian Holm exclusively, what's going on in that scene. And so everyone else in the scene does not know what is going to happen. So when the chest burster, as we now call it, happens and the blood spurts out, no one was prepared for that. So they were getting like blood in their eyes, and the shock you see in that frame is legitimate. And they're all completely freaked out and have no idea what's going on. So if you guys used to watch the scene again on YouTube with that knowledge in mind, it might shed a new light on why some of the performances are so delightfully authentic.
I do enjoy forced method acting. That's always fun to me. And I'm very glad I don't have to experience it, but I do enjoy it from a viewer perspective.
Did anyone else think that the baby version of the alien, when it goes, it was just a little cute.
A little bit.
Yeah. Just a little bit.
Right up until it like smiles at you and it's got those like metal teeth. That's terrifying.
Actually, that's the part I thought was cute, because it makes that noise. It's like, it's like a little demon cat.
And then it like scoots away so like a skateboard.
So, a completely ordinary cat.
Thing 10.
I still kind of maintain that the cat in this orchestrated the entire thing.
Oh, I think they're buddy cops.
Yeah, definitely.
Definitely space buddy cops.
I really would like to see all a webcomic of that. that alien, and was it Jones?
Jonesy the cat.
Yeah.
Yeah. So after this, they kind of rig up a system to detect where the alien is, trying to capture it and find it. And they don't know that it's going to get super big, super fast. But it is our first encounter with the spring-loaded cat of this movie, which happens kind of repeatedly. And it's one of my least favorite tropes within horror movies. I don't like it when you have a jump scare that turns out to be nothing. That, to me, ratchets down my fear.
I think that it worked in this movie on repeated viewings, because this time I know something I've never seen before, and you sort of hear that alien like that little noise it makes when it's still a baby, and you see a shadow go through like a light beam in the scene immediately beforehand, and it's going into the room that they're going into. And I thought that was really interesting, because it is sort of a subconscious way to get you to believe that like it's always like two steps ahead of them, and it's totally plausible that it really was in there, but they saw the cat. So then they ignored, you know, their device, and he went off and it snuck out or something. You know, it's
sure.
It's sort of a tinfoil hat theory, but yeah, it's just one of those little touches that you can kind of notice. It's so quiet and so in the background that it may not even be intentional.
Right.
But it kind of works anyway.
I can't get behind that idea of, okay, this we're going to play
jump scare in well, general.
You know, it's not so much that, it's, you know, we get a big tense scene, we, you know, have the, you know, we set it up so that everything looks like it's gonna, you know, this big thing's gonna happen, and then you play a really loud noise, but it's actually nothing. Like, that can work maybe once, but to me, I feel like it's more interesting if you use that kind of thing to always have genuine fear, because that makes it worse when the next time it comes. For me, the next time there's a situation where I don't know at all what's going to happen, which is not what they do with the next one. So we'll kind of get to that when we get to the first, the second death of this movie. But if you set me up for this big thing and then it's nothing, I take a step back from things personally.
I think in this particular movie, it works, because it's sort of a cat and mouse game.
The first time I would agree. The first time I would agree, but it is something that is repeated throughout the movie of the cat.
Yeah, you know, I can see that. It's sort of like breathing, though. You know, like you have these moments where you get to exhale, and that makes it so that when you have that sharp inhale, because you actually are in the same room with the alien, it makes it a little more intense, because you have that sort of shock value. It's like jumping into a very cold, like icy pond.
Right.
You know, and I think it works when you have those down moments. And, you know, on the one hand, it's a trope, and I feel like just the fact that it's familiar makes it weaker.
It is overused.
And I try to look at it at face value. Like, if it did not exist, I feel like it would make sense that it would keep happening because they're constantly on edge and it could be anything that's making them freak out. Like there's that one moment where they knock over a cabinet in the medicine lab or whatever. And that moment to me works really well as well, because it totally seems plausible that you could be trying to be so careful that you actually do something really stupid that happens all the time.
That's a genuine loud noise that happens. I, what really bothers me is when the music is like there's a big sting on thing.
I don't think
there
was music there.
I remember there being a music sting on that moment and at a later one as well.
I don't think it's in the first one. I think it is in the later one that you're talking about. But that was one of my notes, is that this movie has a surprisingly minimalistic use of score.
Really? I thought it was overpowering.
Well, here's the thing. In certain scenes, it's totally there, and it's actually probably the most prominent moment in the element of the scene. But most movies have the score like throughout, like constantly. In this movie, there's a lot of significant portions of the film that just have no music.
That's true. And they do use that to ramp up the tension very effectively.
Yeah. It's like pretty much, you know, the whole stalking game, you know, where they're just like cat and mouse peeking around corners. And even the climax, like there's very little music in the climax because all you need is the sirens and the flashing lights, and you don't need any more immersion after that.
Right.
And until, you know, you see something new and the music acts as a key, you know, a signifier, say, okay, you cannot capitalize the tension better without music here. And that's what I think the movie does really well, is that it doesn't rely on the convention of necessitating a score. It simply uses it very effectively.
After a long, long series of long, long shots that kind of set you up to just be lulled into a sense of security to a degree, this thing that is suddenly much bigger than we expected just, you know, drops down behind him. And it takes a long time for this thing to kill in almost every situation. Like, it never just runs in and tackles someone. It always seems to wait to, you know, to the worst moment. And even once you've seen it, it kind of just seems to sit there and really take in your terror. And I find that an interesting part of it.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite things about the I keep wanting to call it the Predator, but
you're not necessarily wrong.
Yeah,
just comic bookly wrong.
Right. That's something that really struck me about the alien was how it almost seems to enjoy its kills, like in a certain way. You know, like it takes its time with it. You know, with the, like stalking it and like, you know, setting up the kill. It doesn't just, like you were saying, like just run in and tackle somebody and murder them. Like it's almost like a dance for it, you know.
Yeah.
It's a thing that it builds up to, and then
it's a really good way of putting it.
Yeah, definitely. Which is really disturbing.
Yeah, I agree.
But I think it adds a lot to the suspense and the horror of it, you know, that it cat and mouse, you know, to continue on that theme, you know, which I think is funny that they have a cat.
I don't think it's an accident.
Yeah, I don't think it is either. I think it's a very interesting thematic use.
Yeah, definitely.
It's also the first time, not just that we've seen the alien in the film, but that the world has seen this creation by H.R. Giger. And I think that if the movie was going to get credited with one success, it's the fact that it came up with an extraordinarily original and just, by design alone, terrifying looking monster.
This thing is completely just, ugh.
I mean, you think about like most, like, you know, evil creations in cinema nowadays, they tend to go towards these tropes. It's this giant, you know, humanoid mech thing, or it's just this gray ogre-y blob. And I feel like that in this particular film, you know, there's so much like care and design put into making this as scary as possible.
Well,
just
I wouldn't
in appearance,
even go necessarily scary, but I would definitely use the word alien. I mean, it's, you know, the name of the movie, but this thing does feel unnatural. It feels unearthly.
It is unlike anything that has been produced or designed before, and I think that should be the standard that everyone who has the task with designing a new creature or a new item in a film that is supposed to be completely alien to us, to have that should be the standard. And this film, I think, surpassed that better than any other probably has.
Right.
Huge and credit to its favor.
Definitely. I think the next death is an important one, because it's sort of what you said. This guy feels like he might be the protagonist. He's definitely the cowboy of the group. He definitely feels in charge. He you know, he's the leader.
And this is one of the scariest scenes.
Oh,
to me.
It's so
claustrophobic. Yeah.
You really get a sense of feeling for him as he kind of just squeezes his way through this area trying to hunt down this creature, and it just goes very, very poorly for him, which I think scares the audience more, because he definitely seemed like the one who knew what was going on, who knew what to do. He was the one to come up with a plan, you know,
George R. R. Martin directed one scene.
Yeah, it definitely takes any sense of safety you might have had left over away from you. Any sense of...
He's definitely the most confident-seeming character, other than Ripley. I mean, I think Ripley's probably the most confident character, but he's the second most, almost to a point where he's brash, where he's like, you know, we have more repairs we got to do. I don't care. That's enough to go. Let's go.
Yeah.
And he's the one jumping into the fray. He's sort of the type of person you expect to survive by the skin of their teeth in these situations because, you know, he gets himself into those situations because of his brashness, but his confidence is also what gets him out of it.
And you definitely,
and that's not what happens.
And definitely once he's gone, you feel that in the crew. Like, their hope seems to be gone. Like,
oh, yeah.
Their terror is clear at this point. This thing is hunting them down, and it's scary, which makes it even worse when it turns out that one of their members is not what he seemed to be from the beginning.
It also makes it worse because Lambert just becomes kind of worthless.
Yeah, she really does.
I mean, to be fair, I don't blame her. I probably would have been way worse,
right?
Like, from the chest burster scene, and it's been like, oh God.
Yeah.
You know, but,
and she also isn't one of the characters like Parker that knows what, like, has a thing that she can be doing to make the situation better.
That's
not
true.
Her job.
What was her role? She was like a communications officer.
Communications and navigating, I think.
Yeah, that is not a good, that's not, that's like having a bard in your squad.
Exactly.
It's like, nope, we'd be better with anything else probably.
Right. Yeah, definitely. So yeah, it's, you know, it's understandable that she would go to pieces when she doesn't have anything to distract her really from what's going on.
But are y'all with me though? Kind of can't stand her. Like,
well,
I would forgive her as a real person, but she's definitely like the character I least enjoy seeing on screen. She's the game over man character in this movie.
She honestly doesn't bother me as much as I think she does you, just because at least on this viewing, I felt a real sense of empathy for her as I realized that she just didn't have anything she could do to distract herself.
Yeah.
But I can definitely see where you're coming from. She does feel in a lot of ways unhelpful and annoying, which is all the worse in a terrifying situation like this.
Yeah, she's been completely removed from her element, you know, that she's on that ship to run, you know, navigation and communications. And as soon as that is no longer anything that anybody cares about,
hey guys, there's an alien on board.
Yeah.
I'm doing my job.
Yeah. there's no reason for her to be there. And so all of a sudden it becomes a real, probably, a, you know, kind of an existential question for her of like, why am I here? Why is this happening to me? Which is her experience of the terror.
Right.
Whereas, you know, like Dallas's is, you know, I'm responsible for the crew and I'm going to kill this thing. And like the burden of responsibility, hers is the burden of meaninglessness. You know, that she doesn't have any reason to be there.
That is definitely the kindest way that you could have worded how I felt. I was like, man, she's worthless. And you phrase it in this very eloquent way that made me like, yeah, you're right. I'm wrong.
So
it's like essentially the same thing, but you kind of got me. I'm on Team Lambert now. Poor Lambert.
Poor Lambert.
I feel bad for her now.
So the other character that I think, you know, that we get the big reveal here, you know, of Ian Holm being an android, it's very interesting to me on repeated viewings just to watch him throughout the movie and see what he's doing. See that he has these weird tics about him constantly.
Sir Ian.
Yeah.
He's the man.
He nails this part. It's amazing how well he does it. But I think what's interesting to me is that I feel for his character despite not being human. I get the impression, this is my tinfoil hat theory on his character. I think that what they've done to him by rescinding his responsibility to keep the crew alive, you know, the usual three rules of robotics thing, is destroying him from the inside out. And I think that's why as the movie progresses, he seems to be under more and more strain as more and more people die.
Could buy into that.
Yeah, and I think that at the end, you know, he kind of has this speech about the alien that he admires its purity. He admires that it doesn't have this illusion of morality. And I find that interesting that I think that
that is interesting coming from him.
Yeah.
He theoretically would have none if he's just a programmed robot.
Exactly. I think he has this illusion of, or what he would call an illusion of morality, in that he's been programmed to act in a certain way that would help the crew. But in this circumstance, because of the evil of corporations, because corporations are just the worst.
They're all corporated, dividing their shares up.
They found a way to hurt an inanimate, a technically inanimate object. like to cause it pain.
Man, that's pretty deep, actually. Yeah. I dig this tinfoil hat theory by you, Rick.
Yep.
I mean, I did not come up with this. Like, I want to be clear about that. I have
you jerk. Cite your sources.
Cracked, maybe.
Maybe.
I didn't think you were saying crack.
Like, I mean, you know, crack, that is where a lot of the best theories for fiction come from.
Huh? Jesse. Ash is a good guy the whole time.
Okay, Mr. White.
But yeah, I mean, like, even when he goes to kill Ripley, he does it in the most weird, roundabout way possible by, you know, yeah, and he's acting, you know, bizarre throughout that entire fight, despite the fact that he's clearly way, way stronger than a normal human could
be. I'm always nervous that when I'm showing this scene to people that they're going to start laughing at it because it's so weird.
Like, how did it affect you? I did not realize he was a robot until they smashed his head off.
I think that's intentional.
And yeah. Like, and I was just like, I really was like, this is the weirdest way to kill somebody. Like, why is he all like lock armed? Like, mm-hmm. you know, this is
how very... is he suddenly stronger than Yaphet Kotto? Right, who's like exactly, a foot and a half taller than him.
Right. You know, it's like, okay, there's clearly something about this guy we don't know. Oh, it's that he's a robot.
And, yeah, it's a bizarre scene, but it's really interesting, especially on repeated viewing.
Like I love how the first like hint we get is that he's sweating this white substance from his forehead. And it's like, you have to remember, you know, this, like you said, this is a lived in universe. It's pretty well fleshed out. There's a lot of background stuff that they thought about. And that's one of them, that robots, they are filled with this milky blood instead of normal blood, and they're made out of tubes.
Yeah.
And this guy, he starts sweating this white stuff because... in the world, that makes sense. But to us as the viewer, that's a signifier just to get us ready to believe that there's something different about him. Yeah. You know?
And I thought it was goop from the alien.
Like it was just dripping from the ceiling?
That he was like standing there like it's right above me, like trying not to make any sudden movements. And I was like, okay, well, like why aren't they getting weapons or
right.
you know, doing something to fight the alien? And then I realized, it's like, oh crap, because he's a turncoat.
Yeah.
For me,
he's the most interesting character in the movie.
Oh, I would agree. I'm a huge Ripley fan. I think she's definitely one of the strongest and most iconic, you know, protagonists, female or otherwise, in science fiction. But
personally,
at the same time, Ash is very compelling to watch in this particular installment.
Yeah, and I feel she's more interesting, at least to me, in the sequel than she is in this one. Because
they do a little more thematically with her.
Exactly. I like a lot of what they work with on her in the sequel. So yeah, but after this, you know, we kind of get the most overt scene of the rape in this movie, of, you know, the when it kills the last two characters, there's that scene of that always just makes a shiver go up my spine, of the tail coming up between the girl's legs before it kills her.
Yeah, like, it's
that
hard.
That is terrifying.
That is very disturbing, especially with the subtext in mind.
You get that, and then you get this look on her face of just tense, like waiting for it to happen. And then the last part of it is that always just
the sounds
worst.
on the
radio. It's just that moment is to me one of the most perfect moments of horror in film. It's amazing.
It is very effective. It is definitely one of the hardest scenes for me to watch in horror, but like all horror, you know, the best ones you want to keep watching because the craft is just so well done and you want to admire their commitment to the storytelling. And this is definitely an example of that. It almost works too well in a way. Yeah,
definitely. They kind of, you know, give this thing throughout the next few minutes of giving you a situation where they're like, okay, Ripley's going to get away. Oh God, this thing has gone wrong. Okay, she's going to get away now. Oh God, this other thing has gone wrong. And just, you know, constantly pulling the rug out.
Oh, you're talking
from
about the actual climax now? I love that this follows her coming across the bodies. Like, she was going to rescue them, hearing those sounds. It gives you a sense of, like, this woman is the real deal. Like, she, you know, she's frightened, but she is still willing to do what needs to be done. And that gives you, up to that moment, up till the moment she sees the bodies, I think, a sense of hope. But after that, you just want her to live and you just want her to get out of there because the look on her face and the sense of, she just has this quiet franticness from then on out. She doesn't care about anything. And you can't blame her. She's the last one. She just wants to get out.
Except the cat.
Except the cat. And I just think the whole climax here of her getting out is masterful.
It is, like, just because the sounds are terrifying, they're disorienting. The smoke that's coming on from all the pieces that are falling apart and breaking is you know, lets you think, okay, that alien could be in that smoke at any moment. They're just constant things going wrong for her. Every bit of her plan seems to fall apart
the
right
Daft
up until
Punk
the end.
Light show.
Yeah,
it's a sensory overload. That's what it is. And when you're frightened, everything's like all of your senses are on overload because you're trying to be as reactive as possible. Right. And adrenaline. The film plays to that so well. You feel for her because you feel like you are in that moment too. Mm-hmm. And when she comes around the corner and she sees it between her and the shuttle, mm-hmm. and she's already hit the self-destruct sequence, it's just like the alien chokehold thing we talked about earlier. The script is so tight. Mm-hmm. There is no way out. She has very little in her corner at this point, and yeah. that just does so much for tension here.
Yeah,
it is one of the strongest, like, just moments in film in terms of like beat for beat for beat. Like, this definitely just works so well. I if I met someone who's just like, yeah, I just think this is really pretty cheesy, I no other opinions would be taken seriously from then on out. You should drink water and hydrate. Yeah. Okay, whatever.
I mean, just drink.
Didn't like Alien.
This is a delicious bottle of sand.
Mm. I'm gonna drink sand now because that's so, how wrong you are.
So after that, though, you know, she gets on the shuttle and everything's fine, right?
Well, no, almost. She has to go back and she has to do the thing again.
Like I said,
it doesn't work.
Like I said, it's constantly giving you a sense of hope. Okay, she's gonna get away, and then the rug is pulled out from under her, and it just keeps doing that over and over again.
Okay, well, yeah, let's jump to back to the shuttle then. Nothing else to really talk about there. She gets the cat. Jonesy comes with her. Mm-hmm. She gets back on the shuttle
after a scene of the alien staring directly at it in its cage, and it's the only one that the alien never tries to kill.
That's a which wallpaper furthers, moment.
Goes to prove which furthers the cat is the mastermind.
Yeah, exactly. I think that the alien is in whatever alien language it speaks, going, "What is thy bidding, my master?"
Oh yeah, they're in cahoots for sure.
Definitely.
The real tinfoil hat theory.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
But yeah, you know, she gets in the shuttle and, you know, she escapes and the ship explodes with the alien on it and everything's
three
fine.
Times.
Yeah.
Three, somehow.
Three gigantic explosions.
Yes, because that was necessary.
It does feel very final, though. And that's me, the intent.
This movie came out a couple years after A New Hope, right?
Yeah.
I just like, know. Ridley
we need
Scott
to make this three
like,
times okay. bigger. Okay, do it okay. three times. Yeah. Not what we said. No, come back, Ridley.
No, I do. I honestly do think that it is there to kind of just punctuate. Okay, that thing has to be super duper dead, which it obviously isn't. And I actually really don't feel like this scene works for me.
You mean the three explosions?
No, I mean the scene that comes after that.
Oh no, I love it.
It does not work for me.
I don't understand why. We've had this conversation before, well, but now we're gonna have it again.
Let me at least explain for the listener's sake.
No.
Oh.
I'm gonna turn your mic off real quick.
But no, for me this doesn't work because the alien has been so predatory, has been on at every level, just coming after them constantly. And here I feel like it practically just hands its ass out the door. Like, it is so easy for her to kill. Like, all she has to do is vent the ship, and it just lays there the entire time, and that just does not work for me at all. Why would it
sleeping.
Suddenly? Why it hasn't shown any?
I don't know. It's
has
an animal.
Okay, that doesn't work. That's not scary. It's not hard to get away from a sleeping lion. You Isn't just walk it, away
I
quietly.
Thought, I thought we were in agreement that it was in cahoots with the cat. What's well, the cat's probably number one interest?
The cat probably didn't be like, okay, well.
We should probably nap now. Yeah. Haven't napped in a while.
Blew up the ship. That's a whole
but
lot
seriously,
of stuff.
Find a done. Sunny spot.
As she's trying to get away from this thing, it just lays there. That's all it
I
does.
I like it. I honestly think
Why?
It works really well.
What works about that for you?
To me, what works about it really well is it's sort of the same thing I've already mentioned twice, but it's again here. It's the tightness of the script and what's necessitated for our protagonist to get out of that situation.
So
and
we to have me, to have the villain literally let her kill
well,
it?
Hold on. No. Okay. What it requires is it requires for the first time, well, I guess you could argue that they've done this before, but they haven't had any success with it, which almost makes it more scary. Our protagonists have to show initiative in getting rid of it. Up to this moment, the last like 30 minutes have just been, let's get away. Let's get off the ship.
I mean,
and hold on, let me finish. Okay. So at this point, you know, we've been in a giant ship. You know, there's been a lot of room for them to maneuver. They've had some tight corner moments, but they have a lot of flexibility. They can go get weapons. They can come up with new plans. This is the first time the protagonist and the alien have been in tight spaces well, and our protagonist Alice. Has the upper hand, has an opportunity to have initiative. But the only way she can really take advantage of it is to sort of give it the illusion of having an advantage itself, which is by, you know, waking it up and turning her back to it so that she can turn on the controls to, which I noticed this time that you can see in the reflection of her helmet that she's actually, you know, doing stuff on the panel. She's setting stuff up. She's not just turning her back for no reason, which is for some reason what I thought she was always doing. I was like, are you trying to mentally psych yourself out here? I guess that works too. But to me, I think it makes it easier to root for Ripley here and to really want her to succeed, because if she fails, she's literally in a way burying herself because she has to wake up the alien for this plan to work. And once she wakes up the alien, it's going to know that she's there and it's going to come straight for her. You know,
would it be scarier if it was just coming straight for her and she didn't, it wasn't like sleeping? Wouldn't that be scarier if it was like trapping her?
Not to me.
How would it not be? It'd be like
the way I just explained it.
The thing of it is that situation is the exact same situation we saw Dallas in, except it came in and ate it like a real villain, like should.
I think like a real villain should, sure. But the difference here is that the alien is still stalking Dallas. Dallas didn't actually have the upper hand on the alien. And that's a unique position that we haven't seen in the movie yet. And I think that for horror, that's very important to constantly put your characters into situations where you're not exactly sure how something's going to turn out.
I would disagree that he didn't have the upper hand, because from what we're seeing, yeah, he's in a cramped situation and it's scary, but he has a weapon. He supposedly knows where it is because the girl is feeding him information on it. Like, he should know where it is. And it's when that is subverted that it becomes terrifying.
I think it becomes terrifying because Ripley has to kind of intentionally hand the upper hand to the alien to try to make her plan work, which she, I mean, we know it's going to work because we've seen the movie before. But when I first saw this scene, I was pretty dang terrified, and it worked really well for me because I didn't want her to die that way if it was not going to work.
I was and terrified that made me in pretty, that scene up until the moment it like shot its hand out at her. And then just like, I'll eat you later. And just kind of curls back up and goes back to sleep.
That's pretty much the whole scene. That's when it starts. You don't know the alien's in there until that point.
No, that's what I mean. I actually do like that part of it. I like that the vulnerability of it as she gets undressed. I mean, that's I think, the purpose of that. Cameron called out the male gazeness of that during the movie. But I think in this rare instant, it actually does serve a purpose of making her feel more vulnerable to be that way. But I mean, it just,
well, let's see what Cameron's thoughts are on it are. Cameron, what do you think of the final scene of the movie?
I liked it. I liked it. I was a little bit confused by why the alien would be sleeping there or just like chilling. My initial impression was like, she gets ready to go to sleep or whatever. She's getting everything ready,
putting the cat in the one of the
puts the cat pods. In the pod, takes all her clothes off, and then like, I don't know, she's like reaching on a panel or something, and all of a sudden it's like, hey, I'm here, you know, and his arm pops out like, mm-hmm. howdy neighbor, and then it didn't do anything, and I was kind of like, oh, that's weird, like it didn't hit me like that it was asleep or hibernating or whatever, but it almost makes me wonder if maybe up until this point, all of the people that the alien has killed could also be perceived as a threat.
So you're saying maybe it's not even sleeping, maybe it's conscious, it just doesn't care about Ripley?
I think, well, I was just thinking about, you know, that maybe...
Who are you thinking of as a threat? I mean, the first guy it kills is that random worker dude, and he's just looking for the cat. Then you have the two.
Thinking about it from a territorial perspective.
Oh, okay. I see. Like that, it coming into its
right,
area.
You know, that it is now claimed the ship or whatever as its territory, and now there are people poking around and noises being made and stuff. So it's gonna
waking it from its sleep.
Yeah. Well, not necessarily, but you know, just
right. I see. I do see what you're
it's
saying.
It's a theory, you know, it's a theory, you know, that on the ship, it's still, you know, it's still an adolescent, like, you know, it's still growing, like kind of temperamental and going crazy on people. And at this point, Ripley has been running away from it pretty successfully for a mm-hmm. while now, to the point where maybe it becomes convinced that she isn't a threat and therefore has no reason to devour her. Or maybe it knows it's going to be a long spaceship trip.
And it wants to eat
a snack, for later. You know, just thinking, you know, like how intelligent is the alien, you know, and what could its intelligence actually be what drives it to make that decision rather than a primal need to hunt or feed.
Right.
I think there's that angle to be considered, that perhaps maybe it had decided she was not a problem and was expecting her to be frozen, you know, and go to sleep for whatever reason.
Sure. I guess I don't like that necessarily in light of the way that the android describes it. You know, he kind of gives this ruthless aggression, the android could be wrong, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
He could be right too, in that like its problem is that it doesn't, or well, its benefit is that it doesn't have a moral conscience. And what Cameron's saying doesn't play into morality. It's
well, no, just, what
I, it, if it wants to hunt, it's going to hunt without remorse.
What I was saying, well, what I was saying is he says specifically something about it being like purely aggressive and overwhelmingly so. And to kind of just go back to sleep is not aggressive. And that's the part that I'm talking about. Not necessarily the morality part.
I wonder what significance the cat has to do with it, because there's got to be a reason that the alien never ate the cat. Lord knows it had plenty of opportunities.
It might not have been able to open the cage. That's always been my theory.
Yeah, I wonder maybe if there's something
too
more
small
to
of
it.
A snack.
I wonder if there's something more to it that maybe just the same way that, you know, it's kind of like a game recognized game kind of situation, you know, where the cat is a predator, you know, and this alien is a predator. Pardon the severe convoluting terms,
sure.
but you know what I mean? Like, you know, that perhaps maybe there's a mutual respect there. And because the cat has been in the pod with Ripley, like maybe the cat's scent is in there, and maybe the alien is like continuing to respect it. So it knows like, okay, the cat's here, like everything's cool. I'm gonna take a nap. Okay. You know, like maybe, I don't know, again, more tinfoil hat theories.
Sure.
But, yeah, it's another one that I really dig, but I also don't know if Ridley Scott even thought that far. Like, I mean, well, on your point, like it has always been something I've sort of had to like rationalize, like why didn't it eat the cat? I guess it couldn't have opened the cage. Really? It's pretty strong. Well, it could have just broken the cage, I guess. Yeah. Well, maybe it doesn't actually see it because it's so small. I don't know. Like it is kind of odd. It's an odd thing.
Yeah. So we want to get into final thoughts?
Yeah, I could go ahead and get into final thoughts as long as we all agree that the final scene is amazing.
I mean, we don't, but...
Great, we're all good there. Thoughts. All final scene good. Awesome.
I mean, I'll be able to talk about it again because, you know. Anyway, go ahead. You first.
Do we want to end with Cameron or start with Cameron?
I say end with Cameron since this is his first viewing.
That's fair. Okay, in that case, I will go first. I really, really admire this movie a lot. The craft is just... so strong. It's, you know, as with all strong horror movies, they can be a little intimidating to watch, but when you admire the craft so much for what it is, it's just something that draws you in and works very effectively. Definitely, I think, one of the best horror or science fiction films that has ever been made. I would say my favorite scene is definitely the hallway chase between Ripley and the alien. Well, I guess it's more of a hallway flee, really, with the strobe lights going off, the multicolors, and just the it's like I said earlier, it's just all of your senses are on high alert in that moment, and you're terrified for Ripley, but you're still 100% rooting for her, and she has all of the odds stacked against her, and it just works so well as the capstone to the climax in this film. Just masterful work. And that's another scene that actually has, you know, no to very little score until you see the alien as she curls around that hallway, where it has a pronounced, you know, string moment. And that works really well, but up until then, you know, no score. That's something I always find really compelling too, when the movie can make it work without that element. My least favorite scene is a little more tricky, and I might need a second to ponder over it. The shuttle landing on the planet, for the most part, I really like, but it just seems to last just a little too long. Like, we're ship's going down and we're like, okay. And then we cut to everyone's faces and they're all hitting buttons. And then the ship's still going down. Okay. And we cut to everyone's face and they're flipping more buttons. They're saying things like 4, 9, or 7, 12, 4, 9, or 7, 8, 6. 412, 412, 412.
Right.
And just goes like that for what feels like a really long, long time.
Sure.
And then when they finally land, the landing doesn't seem significant. I can totally believe that it is, because, you know, in the same way that a plane is more complicated to fly than a car is to drive, I'm sure that a space vessel of that size is way more complicated to land than it is to park a car as well.
Right.
But with that huge buildup that doesn't feel like it's building, it just feels like they're landing, it didn't really stick for me. So I would probably say probably that sequence. It's a little lackluster, but even then, you know, I don't actually fault it, because it's still a part of the movie that I think is necessary and
it does
very
help
strong
serve
and
what it works, purpose, you know, is doing.
It's just an aesthetic and personal thing, I guess. I don't buy that it lasts that long. In conclusion, I mean, I think this is as close to a perfect movie as you can get. If you have not seen it for whatever reason, I don't know. I don't know why you haven't yet. It's fascinating and a film that any filmmaker should definitely watch if they want to appreciate the craft. Ridley Scott directed this immaculately, in my opinion. And I mean, look at the numbers. It started a huge franchise and half of it's good. So yeah, I mean, I am actually going to give this the rare coveted 5 alien eggs out of 5.
Nice.
I think it's perfect.
For me, to talk about my favorite scene, I'm glad that Chris brought up the hallway scene that he did, because I'm tempted to talk about that, but because of that, I can kind of talk about a little bit about the android scene instead. I think it's the most interesting character moment throughout the scene. Throughout the movie, rather.
Which scene are you talking about?
The scene where he's revealed to be an android and they kind of have their conversation with him.
Okay, the fist fight.
Yeah, well, not the fist fight, but mostly the scene after that, where they actually talk to him after his head's been ripped off.
Oh, interesting. I wouldn't have guessed that.
I really like it for the reason that I kind of brought up when we talked about it. It's very interesting to me. It provides the most character depth to me. It is, he's kind of the most interesting character in a lot of ways. There's a lot of things to watch him for throughout the rest of the movie because of that. It makes the movie much more rewatchable to me. So that's definitely my favorite scene for the reasons I listed when we talk about that. So my least favorite scene is obviously the last scene. I feel like that up until this point, we have a perfect monster that is constantly on the aggression. It is constantly terrifying. It never has a moment of weakness until it feels like they realized, oh, if we want to have this final stinger, well, we've kind of written ourselves into a corner here. It's asleep. Yeah, we'll just pretend it's asleep. And then that's why it doesn't kill her the way it would have killed everyone else in this movie instantly. And that just it takes away a lot for me.
Ask what you would have rather have had happened?
I would have rathered her have to vent the ship without putting on a spaceship or the suit or something like that.
If the movie ended, or like, actually, after she got in the shuttle?
Actually, what I think the best way to do it would be to have it, she kind of crawls into a room where she has to put on the spacesuit, and it is kind of separated from the rest of the shuttle. I wish that it was kind of clawing at the window there, and she somehow found a way from in there to vent it, or put the suit on in there and shot it out, or something like that, with the spear gun. Anything that would make it not asleep in the corner while she, you know, can do whatever she wants to it. Like, that just, it takes away everything for me. There's suddenly a massive weakness that this thing is narcoleptic, and that just does not work for me, so... but other than that, this movie is, I would agree, almost perfect. I can't give it a perfect rating because I feel that scene hurts it that much for me, but I will give it a 4.5, because that's the only real flaw that I can think of with the movie, honestly. So I'll give it 4.5 alien eggs to make Chris a little happier.
Finally, we're winning you over to the one.
No, you're not.
Rating
I'm totally not doing it
the
next time.
Gold standard.
You know what? Because you said that, I'm never doing it again. I will never agree with your standard again.
Well, we'll see about that.
Unless I go before you, because then I can't really help it.
Uh-huh. Yep.
I think, definitely a classic of sci-fi. I feel the same way about it that I felt before I saw it, you know, that like I really respect it and like that it's, you know, pretty much all of my expectations were met of kind of what I thought it was going to be. And
I call that a success.
Yep. I think it's a great movie. Favorite scene probably is going to be when, yeah, the chestburster scene.
Oh, so good. Yeah.
It's just really, really cool, the way that they put it together and just the way that it really kicks the movie up a notch, where like you had like, you know, you thought like, okay, like there's a thing on his face, like it's crazy. And then they like lull you into this false sense of like, okay, well, the monster's somewhere else now. And then it's like, oh, crap. And, yeah. You know, it's just like, it just really like knocks the movie up a few notches.
I like a lot that all three of us have different best scenes, but I feel like I could have talked about any of those scenes as my favorite scene.
Yeah, they all work very, very well. Yeah.
Least favorite scene for me is the scene when they talk with the, like they put the android head back on the guy's body.
Oh, so Rick's favorite.
Solely because of the special effects snafu in that scene.
Oh yeah, that
characterization,
is rough.
The conversation, all that was fantastic. I'm not faulting any of that.
Right, yeah, no,
it's
I agree.
Entirely just because I just really feel like they shit the bed on that one.
They you did. Know,
they could have just done such a better job with that, considering all the other incredible things that they did in this movie. And I just wonder what happened in production or post-production or how they messed up or whatever that led to that. Because it just, they did so many other things so well that I just have a really hard time believing that that was the best they could do.
The more I watch movies that are from like the 70s and earlier, the more I feel like those scenes exist. And it sort of makes me think, and this is probably going to be borderline offensive to everyone who saw this in theaters, but I keep thinking about like The Great Train Robbery, which is one of the first like silent pictures. And in it, it features a scene at the end where like a cowboy points a gun at the audience and shoots it. And like women would faint. Men would try to flee the bullet. They would literally get out of their seats and run the opposite direction. Like, there's a man with a gun. It's like, I wonder if like with every new film that comes out and sort of saturates pop culture, the craft gets a little smarter and a little better at figuring out, oh, like this is a trend that can become noticeable. If you don't have a scene between cuts, that's called a jump cut, and you can notice things you try to get away with. So you can't really do that anymore. I wonder if this is sort of at the cusp of that.
I can definitely understand that. I mean, I specifically, kind of going along with your point, I remember watching Jumanji for the first time and thinking, wow, those animals look amazing. And I remember watching it a few years later and being like, wow, those animals look terrible. So, you know, I think that, you know, as you watch more and more movies, your eye becomes more sophisticated. You can notice things like that a lot more.
Especially now that the Jungle Book's come out and 99% of it is not real. It's like in the future, we're going to be looking back at these old movies like, what, did they actually have an actor on set? This looks awful. Is this even a movie?
Yeah, I see what your points are, and that's a very fair and balanced perspective, Fox News. And, but at the same time, like to my point, that it's that effect was so bad in the light of all the other incredible...
It won an Oscar for visual effects.
Yeah, I mean, like, for all the other, like, things that they did in the movie, I just felt like they really could have done better with that.
I 100% agree.
So that's my whole thing, is that, you know, if that was the only scene in the movie that had some form of special effects and everything else was like just a lot, like a totally different story, you know, like if it, you know, but that they just had that one scene where an android's head comes back to life or whatever. And it was like, that's how they did it. It'd be like, okay, that was creative on whatever they could do. But with everything else that they do in the movie, between the chest burster, all the models that they have for all the spaceships and stuff, the alien itself, you know, all that stuff, like that, I just feel like they could have done something better with that.
To me, there are two ways a movie can be dated. And one, to me, I sort of don't really consider valid because it just doesn't affect me. You know, I don't have any grounds to understand it really. But the other one I totally get. And it's that it's what's the moments that, well, I'll explain.
Okay.
It's, those little techniques that we've sort of adopted and have decided are like, you know, this is a sin if you don't do this. You know, it's like there should have been a cut between those two moments, at least to provide the illusion that, you know, we have a moment to forget what the head used to look like. So then we can cut back to, you know, Ian Holmes having his head through an actual hole in a table, you know, and
right. That
forgives it, you know, but that sort of dates the movie since that wasn't clearly a priority at the time. And I'm wondering if it was, you know, it being in the 70s. But the other thing that does date the movie, but doesn't bother me, is sort of the nature of the technology, you know, really horrible, like computer interface. It's all green type. You know, it doesn't bother me because
it used to very much bother me. I know I brought that up specifically a lot when we would discuss this movie. But
I was curious to see how you're going to respond to that.
There are parts of it that I still kind of am bothered by, but it's mostly things like the entire room full of Christmas lights that throws me off.
Like Mother.
Yeah, that does. But the
interface, I like Mother itself, for the thematic use and
definitely.
How it works
and,
in the movie.
And I think that the you know, the green type on the black screen works a lot better for me now than it used to. I just take it as a different universe. It's a different universe with different technology for whatever reason.
Yeah.
And I liked it a lot better this time. So
I feel like whenever you go into any movie, you're sort of, even in just a rom-com that takes place in present day, in a way it's a different universe. There's going to be different rules that come into play that you just sort of, as the audience, buy. And to me, like, you know, technology and what existed at the time it was made is one of those things that, you know, I just sort of buy.
Yeah.
But those jump cuts, I agree. You know, it can really date the film. But so, in general, how much did you rate it?
I don't think did we got there.
That? I haven't gotten that far yet.
Oh,
we interrupted him.
Derailed.
I am so sorry. You had a lot of good points that we wanted to talk about.
I'm going to give the movie 4.5 too small Sigourney Weaver panties out of 5.
Oh, man.
You son of a bitch.
High five.
Don't give it to it. Oh.
So yeah. that is a high score, though. It is rare that a movie gets
I think that's 14 the highest
out of 15.
Yeah, that is. Oh, I never thought of it that way.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. when you aggregate the scores, it really like makes the movie look a lot better.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's a fantastic movie. Like, it definitely deserves its place in cinema history.
Whereas like Ironclad, probably one of the best movies we've ever podcasted.
I do love Ironclad. Mainly because it makes Chris feel the way that Gone Girl made me feel. Yeah. So.
Bye guys, I'll talk to you later.
All right. So this has been Opinionated.
Yep.
Bye.
Ironclad sucks.
Hey everyone, thanks so much for listening to this episode of Opinionated. Wanted to encourage you to check out our website at www.opinionatedpodcast.com. Perhaps you'd like to get in touch with us. Well, thanks to the wonderful newfangled technologies of email communications, you can do so. Simply address your emails to opinionatedmoviereviews@gmail.com. Perhaps you'd like to tell us what you think, but you'd rather not use words. You wish you could just click your mouse. Well, on the aforementioned website I talked about earlier, you can vote in numerous amount of polls. There's one poll tied to each episode, and sometimes the topics vary, but it's usually whose opinion did you agree with most. If it's particularly topical, it might have a different question tied to it. That's all the more reason for you to check out the website. We'd like to give a special thanks to James Shively for composing our theme music for us. And last but not least, if you're enjoying the show, please consider leaving us a strong review on the iTunes store. We really appreciate it. And those 5 rad stars are the best way for us to reach a new audience. So thank you so much if you've already done that. In the meantime, we will bid you adieu, and we will see you on the next one.